Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 12th of September, these are our main stories. An official UK government document warns of the worst-case scenario of a no-deal Brexit, with potentially severe disruption to food and medical supplies. Astronomers have discovered water in the atmosphere of a planet orbiting a distant star. And 2,500 people have been listed as missing in the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian struck last week. Also in this podcast, why the children's TV character Fireman Sam is out in the cold. Food shortages, delays in medicines being imported, and an increased risk of public disorder. These are the stark warnings featured in a UK government document known as Yellowhammer, outlining the worst-case scenario of a no-deal Brexit. Parliament forced the government to publish the documents, but ministers maintain they are not a prediction about what will happen if Britain leaves the European Union without a deal at the end of next month. I've been speaking to our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
I've been a journalist for over 30 years, and I don't think I've ever seen a document like this produced by a British government. I mean, yes, of course, the government will point out this is not a prediction of what would happen if there was a no-deal Brexit, but it is said to be what could happen in a reasonable worst-case scenario. And it really is astonishing. I mean, in many ways, it reads like the sort of script of one of those apocalyptic movies that Hollywood makes, you know, when there's been a sort of terrible flood or aliens have taken over. I mean, I'll just go through it briefly. So it talks about a disruption to the supply of fuel, clean water, potentially medicines. It says certain types of fresh food supply would decrease. Businesses would go bankrupt because the price of electricity would go up. Inflation would threaten the care of the elderly because a lot of the old people's homes are financially in a fragile position. It says, of course, that the low-income groups would be disproportionately affected, that there could be protests and counter-protests across the UK.
I mean, people in Britain at the moment are quite entrenched in their views, whether they want to leave or whether they want to stay in the EU. Do you think such a document could sway people, the idea that, you know, elderly people in care homes might die?
It's a great question. In this incredibly polarised country, one is likely to think that, look, Remain voters will see this document and say, this is insane. How could any British government voluntarily carry out an act of national self-harm? And you might think that what has happened in the past, that the Leave voters have tended to tune this kind of thing out and say, that's just the scaremongering of the Remain side, they're bad losers. I mean, what might be slightly different this time is that this is a document not produced by a campaign that wants to remain in the EU. This is the documentation of a government committed to Brexit.
Obviously, this is going to be the headlines of newspapers all across the country. How much pressure do you think this is going to put Boris Johnson under?
By and large, what you tend to hear in sort of public and in private from ministers is that damage done to the economy by leaving the European Union is sort of outweighed by the damage that would be done to the faith in democracy if somehow the result of the referendum were to be overturned. But I think what this does do is it surely will put a lot of pressure on Mr. Johnson to get a deal, or at least to accept the idea of an extension to the Brexit process to avoid a no deal.
That was Rob Watson. Meanwhile, opposition MPs in Britain are demanding the recall of Parliament after judges in Scotland ruled the decision to shut it down was unlawful and the Queen was effectively misled by the Prime Minister Boris Johnson when she was asked to authorise it.
Each opinion expresses the view that the advice given by the government to Her Majesty the Queen to prorogue Parliament from 9th September to 14th October was unlawful, and that therefore the prorogation itself is unlawful.
The government has refused a demand from Parliament to release internal communications between the Prime Minister's top advisers about why the decision was taken. Boris Johnson has previously said the move was in line with procedure. Our Scotland correspondent Lorna Gordon reports from Edinburgh.
This was a unanimous ruling from the three judges sitting in the inner house at the Court of Session. They said the prorogation of Parliament was, in this instance, a tactic to frustrate Parliament rather than a legitimate use of the power. They went on to say the Prime Minister's advice to the Queen and the prorogation which followed was unlawful and is therefore null and of no effect. One of the judges, Lord Brodie, called it an egregious case of a clear failure to comply with generally accepted standards of behaviour of public authorities. It remains unclear what impact the ruling will have on the 5-week suspension of Parliament, which started in the early hours of Tuesday.
That was Lorna Gordon. Scientists in Britain have made a world-first discovery which could answer one of the biggest questions. Is there life anywhere else in the universe? The researchers say they found a distant planet that has both water and temperatures which could support life. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh has the details.
Astronomers have discovered water in the atmospheres of planets around other stars before, but they've been too hot and inhospitable to be able to support life. Until now. A team at University College London has discovered that a world called K2-18b, with the relatively cool temperatures of between 0 and 40 degrees Celsius and just over twice the size of the Earth, has water vapour in its atmosphere. The team leader, Giovanna Tinetti, said it was an important discovery.
All of a sudden, we have the possibility in the next decade to understand what is the nature of this world, how they form, how they evolved, and in some cases, whether they can support life. I think it's just mind-blowing.
K2-18b is 111 light-years away. That's around 650 million million miles. Too far to send a probe to find out if it's home to life. Scientists think that the best option is to wait for the launch of a more powerful generation of space telescopes currently under development. They could be used to look for gases in the planet's atmosphere that could only be produced by living organisms. The new telescopes are expected to come into service in the 2020s, so it may be then that we'll learn whether life is unique to Earth or that there's alien life on other worlds in our galaxy.
More than a week after Hurricane Dorian battered the Bahamas, 2,500 people are still unaccounted for in the islands, according to officials. They say that number may include people who fled to other areas and shelters. Neda Taufik reports.
The large number of those missing underscores the devastation caused by Hurricane Dorian, but a spokesman for the Bahamian National Emergency Management Agency said some on the list could still be located. Their names have yet to be checked against the government's records of those staying in shelters and those who evacuated. That process is currently underway. Dorian was one of the strongest hurricanes on record in the region. Vast areas were completely destroyed, leaving many residents homeless and in need of aid. Officials say 5,000 people have been evacuated from the two hardest-hit island groups. At least 50 people have died, but officials warn they expect that number to rise significantly. Police are working with coroners and doctors to determine the true extent of the loss.
To the US now, where California lawmakers have passed a bill that paves the way for the so-called gig economy. Assembly Bill 5 will affect workers employed by ride-hailing apps such as Uber and reclassify them as employees rather than independent contractors. James Kumarasamy heard more about this from Pinar Ozcan, a professor at Warwick Business School.
This bill reclassifies a whole group of independent hourly workers as employees and gives them sick leave and pension, and so basically changes their category.
So for them, it is a benefit, but for the companies involved, potentially pretty big costs as a result of this law.
Yes, in fact, it is surely a cost for them. And Uber has, for example, come out saying that their costs will increase by 30%. In a sense, from an economic point of view, it is bad news for the gig platforms.
Are all workers happy about this?
On the one hand, this is an improvement for the workers in all aspects. However, if transaction volume on the platforms goes down, these platforms end up being not as cheap as they were before. And therefore, for example, if an Uber driver can't get as much work because there's just not as much interest due to the higher prices, then of course it's a double-edged sword.
So is there any way that this can be fought by the companies?
Yes. So what they're proposing, for example, in California already, is that they want to put it to as a referendum to the people in California. The increase in costs is making a certain group happy, but the majority, there's many more ride-hailers rather than ride-hailing service providers. That means that most people would say probably just for their own benefit that cheaper services are better. But I highly doubt that they would get such a referendum. It would just not be fair.
So when you look at the gig economy in the round, what sort of state of health is it in at the moment, would you say? And what does this legislation tell us about where it is?
The first thing that it tells us is that regulation is now playing catch, and it did catch up in this particular case of California. And in the rest of the US and Europe, probably we will see moves like this. However, this doesn't change the fact that a new set of regulations are needed for the gig economy, because some of the rules and regulations that apply to regular companies just cannot apply to these guys anymore. I'm not talking about employee rights. I think those should be pretty basic. As in every technological advancement, regulation plays catch up, and there's always this ambiguous period in which more is allowed than perhaps it should be. But now we're coming to a stage where the gig economy has matured enough and has reached enough volume, critical mass, for it to now be under scrutiny for regulation.
That was Pinar Ozkan speaking to James Kumarasamy. Still to come on this podcast: ...18 years since 9/11, the latest pre-trial hearings for the man accused of being the mastermind behind the attacks. A 14-year-old girl in Kenya has taken her own life after allegedly being shamed in class for having her period and staining her uniform. Hundreds of parents protested outside the school in Nairobi on Wednesday following her death. Luke Jones heard more from our correspondent in the capital, Rhoda Odhiambo.
The incident happened last week on Friday. According to the parents who already presented a statement to the police, they said that the girl went to school on Friday, and while she was in class, she started her period and she had nothing to use. And her classmates told her, the girl's mother, that she was later thrown out of class and shamed, saying that the teacher told her that she was dirty and told her to wait outside. Then she went home, she took a bucket, and then she went to fetch water by the river, and then she never came back. So her body was found, and that's when the parents were trying to find out what happened, they realized that all this culminated when she was in school.
And what are some of the other parents saying about this? What's the school saying about this?
So the school hasn't commented because the police are already investigating the matter, but other parents within the region where it happened and in Nairobi and also online are saying that they're very shocked at what happened, because you wouldn't expect a teacher to shame a girl because of her menses. And period shaming not being the bigger picture here, we also look at the issue of period poverty, girls not being able to have access to sanitary towels, like in the case here, is something that people don't generally get to talk about. Even the fact that, how do you even tell your child that this is what happens when you have your first period, this is what you're supposed to do, what you're supposed to use. So all these things were not really looked at per se. But it's not only an issue that is prevalent in Kenya, it's also in other African countries. But in this case here, so the police are already looking into the matter, and hopefully we should be able to get some answers very soon.
And of course, Kenya passed a law back in 2017 to provide free sanitary towels for schoolgirls. Mm-hmm. So why is this still a problem? Why is this happening?
So when the law was passed, the sanitary towels were supposed to be distributed to all girls who are in public schools. But unfortunately, not all public schools are able to receive this sanitary towel. So we can say that the law hasn't really achieved much. You find that most people would have to use other things like old clothes, maybe tree bags when they are on their periods. And this is very unhealthy. But lobbyists and other people are trying to lobby the government to zero rate the cost of sanitary towels and even exempt them from taxation, because the cost of a sanitary towel being approximately $1 is not something that everyone can afford. It's a luxurious commodity to many people living in the country, and especially those living in absolute poverty would have to choose between a sanitary towel and buying food.
Wednesday marked the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, a day for remembrance in the United States and for further legal action against those accused of being involved in the attacks. We'll get to that in a moment from Guantanamo Bay. First, the sound of the memorial service at Ground Zero in New York, the place where the Twin Towers at the World Trade Center came down and most of the nearly 3,000 victims were killed.
Daniel David Bergstein.
Graham Andrew Berkeley.
Michael J. Berkeley.
And my mother, Arlene Ava Freed. Not a day goes by that we don't think of you and miss you.
Meanwhile, on the same day, more than 2,000 kilometres further south at Guantanamo Bay Detention Camp, the latest pre-trial hearings for the man accused of being the mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He, along with four other defendants, appeared in court today. Also there, the Guantanamo reporter for the New York Times, Carol Rosenberg.
Came in, was brought by guards, was wearing a typical Middle Eastern robe that he does. He has this strange, large, orange, hennaed beard, and he had a little beige off-white skull cap on his head. And he sat there with his legal team while in court. The prosecutor announced that this being 9/11, the victims who were watching would be walking in and out to have private memorial services. And there was an acknowledgement that, you know, this episode happened 18 years ago. And then the judge basically said, whatever goes on outside this court has no bearing, and let's get going. And the substance of the morning was lawyers for these men, the five men accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks, trying to get details about the interrogation, the torture, as they call it, of them during the 3 and 4 years they were kept in the CIA black sites after their capture and before they were brought to Guantanamo and taken out of incommunicado. And this is a death penalty case, and the defense lawyers are trying to get some pretty graphic and specific details in order to argue to the eventual U.S. military jury that will hear this case that what America did in between 2002 and 2006 when they held Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his four alleged accomplices in the black sites has tarnished the ability to prosecute these men. And the second part of it is, should they be convicted, which, you know, the evidence involves their supposed voluntary confessions to FBI agents after the black sites. Should they be convicted, they want enough information to be able to show those military juries in words, if it's not pictures, what America did to these men rather than take them straight to justice in New York to argue that the U.S. has lost the moral authority to execute them. So it's been going on for some years, and it's a struggle between the defense for as much details as they can get from these CIA black sites to argue that any confession they gave was contaminated, and the prosecutors saying they've given them enough evidence, let's get on with this trial, and the victims deserve justice.
That was Carol Rosenberg from the New York Times. Social media influencers, smartwatch developers and blockchain engineers. These are among the jobs that didn't exist a decade ago. But how about this one, the virtual intern? Yes, while many people think that an internship involves getting coffee and lots of photocopying, these days you don't have to turn up to the office to be part of the team. Technologies which enable employees to work away from the office are giving rise to a growing trend, virtual internships. Our reporter Deborah Weitzman has been finding out more.
Thank you for helping our team on Project Jewel. We would like you to prepare 3 slides as part of our proposals.
This is one of the assignments given to interns at the law firm Linklaters. But unlike traditional work experience, the task you just heard is part of a virtual reality platform, and one that is more likely to be carried out in pyjamas than in a suit. Linklaters launched its digital internship scheme over the summer, and already thousands of students have signed up.
We strongly believe that the best legal teams comprise of diverse people from different backgrounds.
You have videos of partners that work at LinkNators who give you the task, give you your deadline. You see the partner sat behind a desk, so it does feel as if you are literally sat in front of them.
That's Jessica Fitzpatrick, a third-year university student and digital intern.
I have quite a busy schedule. I'm a student. I tend to go running quite a lot. I have a part-time job. So having it on your mobile or your laptop means that you can do it anywhere without putting yourself in a high pressured situation where maybe people are going to be giving you feedback and watching you to see how you progress.
So why would a company turn interns into outterns? I've hopped on the London Underground and I'm heading to the heart of the city's financial district to find out. I'm currently sitting in Linklater's offices with Alison Wilson. She's a graduate recruitment partner at the firm.
What we're definitely not trying to do is move away from a real internship because that gives people an opportunity to find out if they're the right candidate for us and we're right for them. But what we're trying to do is have a new kind of precursor tool that gives somebody the inspiration to think, yes, I could do that job. This is a career that I find interesting. For someone who perhaps has never had any work experience of the legal profession, might be sat in their university holidays in a town in the northeast of England, so it's not very easy to pop down to London and you know, see what's going on.
Every year, approximately 70,000 physical internships are undertaken in the UK, according to social mobility charity The Sutton Trust. A substantial amount of these are unpaid, and access to prominent firms is often by the way of connections, so both social and financial capital are required. Digital internships could certainly help to break down some of these barriers, according to the charity's chief executive, James Turner. But he also identifies a potential red flag.
I think there is a concern that there'll be a sort of two-tier system developed. So the internships with real currency, the internships which employers value, which really develop the skills of young people, they'll be the ones that are in person and they will continue to be accessed mostly by those who are better off and have connections. And then there'll be the second set of internship experiences, which may not be quite as valuable.
All assignments will be sent via email, group work will be done on WhatsApp, and we'll hold video calls and Skype meetings regularly.
Josephine Adetti from Kenya interned for an online magazine located thousands of miles away in Dubai. But after 7 months of working from home, she felt burdened by technology overload.
Much of the internship required that we push ourselves to complete assignments as no one would banish us. After all, we were very many miles away.
Would you recommend people to do a virtual internship?
Yes, as you have nothing to lose. It doesn't interfere with your schedule, but if you are an extrovert, physical internships will do you more good.
Remote and flexible working is becoming more and more popular for businesses around the world. Virtual internships could therefore help to prepare a future generation of workers. But for many interns, face-to-face interaction with an employer, even if that means doing their photocopying or fetching coffee, could still be the key to unlocking that dream job.
That was Deborah Weitzman. Apple has launched its new mobile phone handset, the iPhone 11 range, but some people say its new design with three camera lenses is triggering a phobia. Richard Hamilton reports.
The three lenses on the iPhone 11 Pro sit alongside two other holes for a torch and a microphone. Hundreds of smartphone users say watching the handset being unveiled triggered a condition known as trypophobia. This is an aversion to the sight of clusters of small holes, and its symptoms include feeling sick. People tend to get it when they look at things like lotus seed pods, crumpets, or even aero bars. Dr. Jeff Cole from the University of Essex in England, who himself suffers from trypophobia, conducted the first full scientific study of the condition in 2013. He believes there's an evolutionary reason for it.
The mathematical structure of a trypophobic stimulus happens to be the same as the mathematical structure of the warning collars on poisonous animals, and it's quite a unique visual signature. So we think what's happening is when a person looks at a trypophobic stimuli, there's an old evolutionary part of their brain trying to tell them that the trypophobic stimulus, it might be a poisonous animal. So when you're looking at aerated chocolate, Your brain is trying to tell you, hang on a moment, I've done the mathematical analysis on that chocolate. It's the same as a poisonous animal. I think you might be looking at a poisonous animal.
Although fear of small holes may sound like an obscure phobia to have, Dr. Cole says as many as 16% of the population suffer from it. He says the scientific context is well established, as many people are averse to different kinds of visual stress. For example, flashing lights can trigger epileptic seizures, and patterns of stripes can cause migraines.
That was Richard Hamilton. Now, Fireman Sam, the popular cartoon firefighter whose adventures reach homes across the world, has been given his marching orders as the face of a fire department in Britain. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
That's the Fireman Sam theme tune in some of the dozens of languages the TV show airs in worldwide. Sam, the friendly Welsh firefighter, has been the star of it since the 1980s and as a result was adopted as the mascot of the Lincolnshire Fire Department in the UK and then used as a recruiting tool for the service. But now they say he's outdated and he might stop women joining up. They've pulled him as their mascot and dropped him from all promotional material. Here's the chief fire officer for the area, Les Britsman.
This is not about political correctness. We're trying to recruit a modern fire service. The programme itself, you know, the cartoon itself and series is quite up to date, but they seem to have failed to update their key character.
The London Fire Brigade backed him up in a tweet saying the use of the outdated term fireman ingrains in the young that it's a male-only role. Fireman Sam does have a female firefighter, the stoic Penny Morris, but for Lincolnshire that's not enough. Their new mascots are three gender-ambiguous fire extinguishers called Freddie, Filbert and Penelope. Though they've already come under fire for being confusing, with some saying they could look a bit like frogs.
That was Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.